Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast, which means you can go over to 1517legacy.com/podcast and check out the whole family. They're all a family of podcasts over there. There is a whole bunch of podcasts. It is ever increasing. I have little doubt that there is not something else that you would find interesting. I just can't believe that you're a person that the only podcast that you would ever consider listening to would be one in the Old Testament. Maybe that is you. I just don't know. I haven't met that person yet. I feel like there's probably something else over there for you. So go check it out and try a couple out until one hits you just the right way, and then commit. And listen to that for a while. Chad, we have some interesting things coming up, bud.
We do. What's going on?
Well, we're just keeping these city events rolling. We're like, this train is just moving on down the tracks. I know we just got through with North Dakota. That content's not even out yet. Don't worry, it is coming out, guys. You'll be able to check out all that stuff. But we're gonna be in New Jersey August 4th. You can go to that. We're going to be in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Chad, you'll be at that one in Hattiesburg.
I will be.
Yeah, because it's down south, and if it's a southern one, you got to have somebody from the south there.
Got to have
a
southern boy.
That's right.
I'll be there.
That's going to be on September 15th. So August 4th in New Jersey, September 15th in Hattiesburg. We're doing city events. Here's the deal with these two city events. They're different than all the previous city events for this reason. They are 100% free.
Whoa.
Yeah, free.
I didn't know you guys were doing that.
Yeah, these are free events. So every other city event, it's cost you $20 to come hang out with us for a day. But not these ones. These ones are free. We've never done this before, but the churches involved are sponsoring these events. So they wanted to make them free, so they helped us offset the cost. And there's going to be free events. Now, here's the deal, though. We still need to know sort of how many people are going to be there. We need to be able to gauge that. So there's still registration. It's just that the registration doesn't cost you anything. So if you are in the New Jersey area, that would include New York City, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, etc. You should come. It costs you nothing. You should come hang out with us on Saturday. That's August 4th. Go over to Christ Old Fast, go to the events page. You can register. Again, that registration costs you zilch. Likewise, if you are down in the Mississippi area, maybe you live in, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, come on with it. We'll be at St. John's in Hattiesburg. Also, free registration is open. You can go over to the events page, see the lineup, and we'd love to see you there. So we're just keeping these things moving right along because we love hanging out with the people so much that we just can't stop scheduling these things.
A lot going on. Good. Yeah.
And that doesn't even include the fact that if you are maybe you're not in either of those areas, then you probably should just come out to Here We Still Stand in October. So that's the big one. That's the 3-day one. And also, you probably, if you are doing that, should get those tickets because there are only about 80 tickets left for that event.
We're going fast.
Yeah, that's going to sell out. There's about 80 tickets left. If you wait until September, you have waited too long. There won't be any tickets left. So there's only about 80 of those left. And that's the big one. That's the one that you don't want to miss. But, if you're in those other two areas, come hang out with us. All right, Chad. We're cranking away through Leviticus. And, I think we might be at a faster clip in Leviticus. I mean, we're not going crazy fast. We've been in here for a few months now, but I don't think it's going to be the over a year that each Genesis and Exodus were.
No, we've shifted kind of second, third gear. Maybe we're moving along at a pretty good clip here, and part of the reason is honestly that there is some repetition, and we're going to see this actually again in some later chapters in Leviticus. I mean, there's new material, or there's material that's stated in a little bit different way, a little bit different twist on it, maybe something else revealed about a sacrifice that wasn't revealed before, things like that. But sometimes it's simply a, a repetition or application of an earlier text. And in that case, if you're a faithful listener, you've already covered that material, then I'm not going to spend a lot of time going over it again. I think most people who follow a podcast are pretty religious about just following episode through episode. So we won't be covering extensively the same material again. So that kind of helps us a little bit with some of this in Leviticus, and it will also in some of the later books of the Pentateuch as well. So yeah, we are in chapter 18. We introduced that last time, talked a little bit about the content, which is mainly in one way or another related to sexual relationships. We kind of gave some groundwork, some kind of overarching thematic groundwork for why God cares about sex and how it fits into the broader divinely created pattern of creation itself, and how it's not just a private choice that just affects me or me and the person I'm with, but it has much broader societal impact. Anyone who denies that, anyone who tries to privatize sex is kind of living in a cave, as far as I'm concerned, because we see all around us the impact of supposedly private sexual choices having great national societal impact. So what we do is not just a matter of my decision, my personal or private decision with regard to these matters, but affects many, many, many more people. So that we talked about that last time. There's a couple of things that a couple of other somewhat broader insights that are brought up at the beginning of this chapter that I just want to touch on, and then we'll just look at a couple of examples of how this plays out in the chapter itself. One is this is kind of a curious expression, and I think we may have talked about this way back in Genesis, right after the story of the flood, when Noah got drunk and was inside his tent, nude, and his son came in and went out and told his brothers. I think maybe we touched on it then, because if I remember correctly, that's the first time this particular expression is used. And what I'm talking about is this language of uncovering someone's nakedness. So, for instance, verse 6 says, "None of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness." That's one expression. But look at verse 7. Verse 7 is I think even more of an indication as to exactly what this particular metaphor means. So verse 7, I'm Leviticus 18, verse 7 says, "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, that is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You are not to uncover her nakedness." Now, what's going on here? Well, to uncover nakedness can mean a couple of different things. And it is one, like many other parts of the scriptures, it is dependent upon context. Sometimes it means to actually uncover a person's nakedness, that is to reveal them in some way, or more particularly to reveal their nakedness with the result or with the purpose of having intercourse with them. But a lot of times, and we see that in that verse that I just read here, to uncover the nakedness of someone does not mean to uncover that specific person's nudity, but it's a metaphor for uncovering the nudity, the nakedness of someone who is intimately, relationally bound to that person. So for instance, verse 7 that I just read, when it says, "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father," that's not talking about uncovering, revealing your father's nudity. Instead, what that's talking about is revealing the nakedness and the nudity of your mother. Now, the reason it says you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father is because the father and the mother are bound together as one. Just like Genesis chapter 2 says, right? A man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. And so to uncover the nakedness of a man's wife is to uncover that man's nakedness, just like to uncover the man's nakedness is to uncover the one to whom the wife is bound. So there is this idea. The reason I bring it up is there is this idea that what we do sexually to a person that is committed relationally to somebody else, we do to both of them. So it's an offense, for just to use adultery as an example. If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, he uncovers that man's nakedness by sleeping with that man's wife. Just like if a woman were to commit adultery with a married man, then that woman uncovers the nakedness of that man's wife. Why? Because these two are bound together in this one flesh union. So that what happens to the one happens to the other. The reason this is significant is because it once more shows that this isn't just some sort of one-on-one kind of sin that takes place. It's not just a matter that affects two people. It's much broader than that. It's much deeper than that. It is something which affects a community, and it's not just an isolated breaking of one commandment. It always flows out from there to affect other people, because people are understood not to exist in isolation and not just really to be in some way connected to each other, but actually to be bound in some sort of mysterious fleshly union that connects them, and not just husbands and wives, but other members of the family as well. Because this language is used of fathers and daughters, of aunts and uncles, of all sorts of people who are connected by means of the family unit. So that's one of the things that I wanted to throw out there. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, Dan, or not.
I'd say this, that there is no such thing as casual sex. That's just a lie. That's not a thing. There's like that doesn't exist. In conjunction with that, there's no such thing as sort of casual sin. And I know we talked about this a little bit last week, but there is no, because sex involves two people, it cannot be something that affects just you. Now, it probably is going to affect more than just you and the other person, but it's certainly going to affect at least you and the other person, but more than likely more people than that. There will be a ripple effect. And sin is just that way. So sin is, there aren't instances, especially with sexual sin, there is no sexual sin that can be just you, that you're the only one who is affected by this. There's no casual sex, and there's no casual sin. And if you think about it like this, you know, you talk about uncovering nakedness. If somebody goes and if you use adultery as the example, and you go and you know, you sleep with somebody else's wife, or a girl goes to sleep with someone else's husband, part of what you do too, like, is that you uncover it's a damaging thing to the person, not just because like that's their wife or whatever, but you sort of uncover something about them that this person was like obviously not content with them. There's a lot of shame and stuff that goes to the person who didn't do anything, but they are going to bear like a huge load of the consequences and the effects of this. And you've sort of uncovered things like maybe you have a couple whose marriage is not great, and that person ends up, one of those people ends up having an affair. Well, what it does is it says all kinds of things, or people are going to say and assume all kinds of things about the uninvolved person. Like, well, I mean, obviously she wasn't happy. Obviously he wasn't providing for her, satisfying her, enough for her. And so it diminishes this person. It attacks things that are big parts of someone's identity. And so you're uncovering things about them that really, like, the world doesn't have any business knowing about. And you've done that. And that's a sin against that person because you've brought shame upon them. That shame is not just reserved for the two people that engage in the act, but there's a lot. I mean, if you were also the one, like you said, who were connected and bound to this other person, there's a ton of shame involved in that for you, even though you've done nothing. And so you've revealed shame for this person, and that of course is a very sinful thing to do to somebody.
I mean, as you were talking, giving examples, it brought to mind that ultimately the reason that all of these various kinds of sexual sins are wrong is because they violate really the goal and purpose of the law, and that is love, right? God's goal is not for us just to do right, just to behave in a certain sort of way, to toe the line, to make him happy. That's not the goal of the law is not obedience. The goal of the law is love. And so if you want to know why you have any of the commandments, especially the second table of law, with regard to our neighbor, it all goes down to love. So I mean, if you love someone, you don't murder them. If you love your father and mother, you honor them. If you love marriage, then you don't commit adultery, so on and so forth. So it all goes back to love. And then we can see in all these various kinds of sexual sins how they do in a myriad of ways violate love. And bring not love, but shame and guilt and regret and hatred and enmity and all those other nasty parts of this fallen human world into our lives and into the lives of others. So I think that's one of the things I want to point out about this. And just one more, and that is that these aren't just issues that relate to the Israelites, because the way this starts out. This chapter starts out is Moses. God speaks to Moses and says, "Hey, I want you to tell the Israelites that I'm the Lord their God, and that when they go into the land of Canaan, that I don't want you to do as they did, because what happens is they defile themselves, the Canaanites, and because of that, God is going to cast them out of the land." So the Canaanites were practicing all these sorts of things, and that's one of the reasons, as God will say later, that he spews them out of his mouth. He cast them forth in the land because they had polluted the land by acting in a way that was contrary to how God had created them to be. So we have, therefore, in the rest of the chapter, we have all sorts of examples of the violation of the law of love in regard specifically to sexuality. And we have everything from various kinds of incestuous relationships, whether it is with a sister or a stepsister, step-siblings, or any kind of relationship in which family is involved. We have several examples of that, leading daughters-in-law all the way through the first half of the chapter. And then after we get through those, we transition to a few more examples. One of those we brought up last time, this one, I think we brought it up anyway. This one doesn't really seem to fit, but it actually... It fits in sort of a subtle way. I'm looking at verse 21. It says, "Neither shall you give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God. Of the Lord, I am of your God. I am the Lord." That's verse 21. So why in the world in this chapter that has to do with the relationships and with sex, why would the offering of children to this pagan god of the dead named Molech, why would that come up? Well, it's because, as we've talked about before, idolatry is very often pictured as a kind of spiritual or theological or idolatrous adultery, because you are joining yourself in union with that which is a lie, with some sort of false god. And so it comes up here because you have a lot of talk of family, and because any, especially this most egregious example of idolatry, offering a child as a sacrifice to a false god, falls under the same sort of category of a sexual sin, but a sexual sin in a theological sense. So one is committing spiritual adultery by engaging in this form of idolatry.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, Moloch is a god that they make. I mean, in this context, we're talking about like actual human sacrifice. Not, I mean, this is like legit. You offer your child as a human sacrifice to the god of Moloch, and Moloch is a real god, not in the sense that he's real, but he's a god that people did, in fact, make human sacrifices to. I think that the reason that confirms everything that we've said so far, that this is actually about how you love your neighbor and even specifically your family well in the flesh. So what you do with your body and what you do with your family's body or other people's bodies has a lot to do with love. And so while it is, we see the case that, hey, don't use your body to engage with your neighbor sexually, who you ought not engage with sexually. That's bad. There's no love involved there. It's an unloving thing to do. Of course, in the body as well, offering your child's body as a sacrifice to Molech is also not love. And so, in a sort of broader sense, what's being talked about here is the physical body that we have and how it's used, how the ways that we may use it incorrectly. It might seem like a gigantic leap between like, well, having sex with the wrong person versus, you know, offering your child up. But at the end of the day, what God is saying is that both of these violate the familial bodily love that we're supposed to have for one another. But they're not as disconnected as you would perhaps think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're connected by the concern that God has that whatever we do with our body, especially sexually, conforms with how He has created us to live in love with our neighbor. God just isn't concerned about our kind of inner soul or our spiritual life, but He's concerned about our bodily life, because that's how we live. And so he's concerned that what we do with our bodies is going to reflect how He has created human nature to be. Because when we act in a way that's contrary to that, we are denying that the way that God created us is gift. Instead, we are trying to manipulate it to be something that is basically saying that God did not create us in a way that is right, but that we know a better way.
Yeah, and there is actually a sexual aspect to the sacrifice by sort of being non-sexual. So you would sacrifice particularly, you know, undefiled children to Molech. So you're talking about like this is where the old ideas of sacrificing virgins and things like that. So there is actually, when you offer someone to Molech, there's actually where they're at on the spectrum sexually actually mattered. So there is a sexual aspect of that too, that you don't catch the person in adultery and sacrifice that person. You sacrifice the undefiled, you sacrifice the virgin, which is obviously horrific. It's not as though sexuality plays zero role in the sacrificing of people to Molech.
Yeah, yeah. So if you come across that verse and you're wondering, well, what does this have to do with the rest of the chapter? Did it just kind of slip in here accidentally? No, it fits in theologically with the rest of what is communicated. Another verse that we often hear referred to, especially in all sorts of debates and discussions about homosexuality, is the one that comes after that. This is verse 22. where it says you shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. And again, this, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, as a lot of time is spent talking about it in the church today. We will come across more of these as we work our way through the scriptures. But this fits within the broader message of the chapter itself, in that to use your body in this way is to use it in a way that is contrary to the way that God has created it to be. So God from the beginning has created males and females as those who are joined together in marriage for all the various reasons that that are given, including, of course, the procreation of children. So the very way that God has made our bodies from the beginning is in such a way that males are joined to females. Men are joined to women in marriage for companionship, for love, for sacrifice, for the procreation of children, for all the reasons that fit with our humanity. I think another thing that I don't know how often it gets brought up, but I certainly think about it a lot in terms of homosexuality, especially as it relates to marriage. And it's something I don't think that we talk about enough. And that is that one of the purposes of marriage between a man and woman is that it reflects the marriage of Christ and his bride, the church. So when we see a man and a woman joined together as a head to a body, at two people becoming one flesh, then what we're seeing is an image of Christ and his church. This is the earthly icon of the heavenly reality of how Christ has joined all of us together as his body, of which he is the head. So one of the real beautiful aspects of marriage between a man and a woman is that you see acted out what Christ has done for us. So it's really an image of, it's an image of God's self-giving one-way love when a man and a woman become united in marriage. That marriage is an ongoing living image of who Christ is and who his church is. And because that's the way that God has created us to be, that's the way that God has made his church to be, then the union of a woman and a woman, or of a man and a man, does not reflect that. It's an impossibility. So I think that's one part of the teaching of Scripture that doesn't come up enough when we're talking about issues relating to homosexuality. Too often we just get caught on issues of what's right and wrong, or moral and immoral, and forget about these deeper issues that relate to homosexuality.
Again, I would say that all of this is in the context, like you said, of not just doing the right thing because it, just because God said it's the right thing, but it's identifying what is the right, what is the best way to be for your neighbor, what's the best way to be for the society that you live in, right? And so how do you love best? This does not speak to what we would perhaps desire. It does not speak. I mean, people desire to go to go have sex with all kinds of different people. That's certainly part of us. And the idea here is that there are, that God has put forth the ideal way for us to love one another. And sometimes, this is the thing, is sometimes that the way that we love each other best is not necessarily the way that comes natural to us even. It is not natural for me to love or pray for my enemies. But what is certainly true is that if I am faced with the decision of warring and fighting my enemy versus loving and praying for my enemy, the loving and praying is better. It's better for me. It's better for them. And it's better for everyone else. Wars start over hatred. war is a bad thing because war costs people. This all has like sort of snowball kind of effects, and so there are definitely things that we are shown that this is the better way, but it might not feel, it might push against how you feel you are naturally, what you are naturally prone to. And so I would just say that like how we feel is not a good barometer of necessarily how to love one another best. And so I don't ask myself, what would I like? What would I prefer? How do I want to live? Love does not ask the questions like what's the best way for me to live and act for me to feel most fulfilled. That's a self absorbed question. It's a selfish question. What love does ask is how do I live? What's the best way for me to live and be that best serves everybody else? So love is by nature sacrificial like that. So there is a sense in which there may be a laying down or sacrificing something of yourself, something that you feel is better for you for the good of other people. And this happens not just, you know, in what sort of sexual orientation we have or you know, choosing partners or anything like that. It's not limited to that. It expands into like the entirety of our life. I would say that I think that there are sacrifices that we all make for the sake of love of neighbor that feel legitimately like sacrifices because they are.
Yeah, I mean it gets back to the image of that Christ himself gives us of bearing our crosses, and those crosses are going to take a lot of different forms for everybody, and some crosses are going to be a lot heavier for the other people than they are for their neighbors. That's just the way that life is. But one thing is certain, we're all going to be bearing our crosses. We're all going to be feeling the weight of crucifixion that is pressing down against our desires. Because, I mean, I'll be the first to admit that what I desire most of the time is not what God desires for me. It's the exact opposite. I mean, I don't think that most men find it easy to live a monogamous life. For most of us, that seems completely contrary to our nature. We want to have sex with lots of different women. I've yet to meet a man who doesn't experience that kind of temptation. But that doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean that desire is a godly desire that he has created within us. That is basically that's the result of the old Adam's desiring to get as much for himself as he can get. So, but you're right. It relates to all sorts of issues outside of sex. But sex is certainly where one of the places where we feel this most strongly, where we are called into a self-sacrificing life that seems very often completely contrary to what we desire.
Oh, man.
So yeah. So that's enough on that chapter. I believe the rest is looks like covering material that I've already talked about as kind of an introduction to the chapter. So we don't have a lot of time left, but I will. I think we got maybe 4 or 5 minutes left. Just let me introduce a little bit about this next chapter 19, which is the first part of which is actually some pretty straightforward stuff. A lot of basically a repetition of an application of the commandments, everything from the first to the eighth commandment. I think they're all covered in one way or another in this section. But I guess by means of intro, let me say this, that what you see in this chapter several times repeated is a variation of God's way of identifying himself to Israel as their God. So sometimes it'll be, I am the Lord. Other times it'll be, I am the Lord your God. Or at the end of the chapter, it says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. At the beginning of the chapter, he says, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. So over and over in this particular chapter, we have God reminding his people of who he is, but not just who he is, but who he is in relation to them. So when someone is our God, or when God himself says, I am the Lord your God, there's a claim that is made, and there's an access that is granted. So anytime that God gives us his name and says, I'm your God, or we say to him, you are my God, then we have been given access to him by means of his name. We know what his name is. Just like if I want to call someone, holler at someone, if I know their name, I say their name. That's my connection to them. We can call upon God because we know his name. We have a connection to him. He's given access to him. And this access that's given to us imparts to us the holiness that God himself possesses intrinsically and eternally. That's another part of this chapter that we'll cover next time. So when God says at the beginning, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy, that can be translated about three different ways. It can be translated as command in the sense of you be holy. It can be translated as a kind of a future, or you shall be holy, or you will be holy. It can also be translated simply as that's who you are. You are holy. And I think all of those elements are embedded within these verses. Certainly God commands us to be holy, and certainly God tells us that we will be holy, and certainly God tells us that we are holy. So what we're going to see when we come back to this are various kinds of commandments, various kinds of laws, in which the people of Israel are called to lead a life that is in conformity with who God has made them to be. So their activity, whether it's doing good or avoiding evil, doesn't make them holy any more than our doing good and avoiding evil makes us holy. The only way that we're holy is by God making us that way. He sanctifies us. He's always the one who makes us as he is. It's not an achievement. It's a gift. And as those whom God has made holy, he calls us then to lead lives that reflect that gift that he has bestowed upon us. And that's what we'll get to in, I guess, in the next episode.
Yeah, just let me say, as Chad says that as it's sort of like a weighty episode, you are most certainly listening to two guys who have certainly stumbled under the weight of their own crosses, and the good news is that there is Christ who has bled and died on his for our inability to love one another as we ought. Yes, here is the description of, hey, this is the way that you love one another, is be holy, certainly by command, but also you're not going to be. I haven't achieved that. Chad hasn't achieved that, but there is the promise that you will be made holy, that he who bore his cross all the way to Calvary and died upon it for my sins and Chad's sins and your sins is willing and able to holy you. And so the cross can be heavy, and you will no doubt stumble under the weight of it. But the example of love for another that is given has been perfectly displayed in the love of Christ for people who have failed to do so, like us. And so this is the hope and the beauty of the Christian faith. It's why I'm not going anywhere.
Same here. Amen to that.
All right. Well, that's it. We will see you guys next week. Hey, New Jersey, if you're around, come see us. Hattiesburg, Mississippi, if you're around, come see us. We would love to hang out. You can get all the information. Chad, we'll see you next week.
All right, buddy. See you then.